Rob Wolf, Andy D is back with episode 37, Paleolithic Solution. What's happening?
Dude, I hear you've got a touch of the Prowler flu.
Yes, I did just, soon before the show, get home from doing some nice Prowler sprints at the gym. I laid on the floor in the gym for a while and then came home and laid on the floor. And so, I had to drag myself up to the chair. I got some water. So as I told Rob, if I die during the episode, I'm going to die a happy man because I was doing something that I thoroughly enjoy, although probably not at the time was I enjoying the Prowler pushes.
And you probably won't start to smell before the end of the show, too, which will be good.
That's good. Luckily, we don't. There's no mechanism yet by which to share my smell with the world post-workout, so that's probably positive.
It will just literally be dead air coming from your end of Skype. So, cool.
What's going on with you?
Nearing the end of the book. We've been at it for a week. Erich Krauss, the publisher and editor of my book, came to Chico. He used to live in Chico and has basically been camped out in the living room. We're in there like 12, 13, 14 hours a day. We print up a chapter, work our way through it, do edits, argue about semantics, enact the edits. Probably each chapter has been read or reread like 5 times and re-edited, and then that stuff gets shipped off to a copy editor. And knock on wood, like if everything goes right by, although these podcasts are staggered, but by next Friday, my real time here, the whole book should be it should be at the printer, should be in print, and then early to mid August, we should have hard copies that we will start distributing for advance reading and review. And then September 10, everything is full tilt boogie. It's out. So we're getting really close. I am knackered, though. It's a grueling schedule we're on.
Rob, this is why Stephen King only writes like 10 pages a day.
Well, it's not the writing. This is the editing job.
Oh, I know. But I feel like once you've written enough books, you figure out how to pace it.
Yeah. Yeah, nothing. There were a few. We were supposed to start this hardcore editing chunk 3 weeks earlier than what we did, but some different things popped up both in my life and Erich's life, and so it just compressed things. So it'll all be good, but I'm shocked. Like I felt like a lot of the material was pretty good as it was, but Erich is a phenomenal editor and author. He's actually a New York Times bestselling author. He co-authored the book with Forrest Griffin, two books with Forrest Griffin, and so that was a New York Times bestseller, and so he's a great author himself and has really helped me to make the material more clear. And he has a fitness background, but not a background in this paleo stuff, so it's been kind of cool. He was a really good person to read this because it was new material to him, so it had to make sense to him. So it's been a pretty good process, and theoretically the material should make sense to anybody. Whether or not it makes them pass out and fall asleep, we'll see. But we gave it the old college go. So, but it's close either way.
We gave it our best shot. I like that, Rob. Good work. Yeah.
Well, and again, thanks to Andy Dees for he is absolutely the person who squarely planted his foot in my tushy about a year ago and threw down the gauntlet and was basically like, you either need to get this thing done or STFU about considering doing it. So, if and when it's done, it got done because of Andy D's folks. So, but if it sucks, I will take the blame instead of Andy. So,
see, the nice thing is I didn't actually have to write anything. So, I just had to encourage you to move things along. That's a much easier part of the process.
You're good at instigating, dude. You're very good at instigating. So,
it is a gift. It is a gift. Well, we have a nice group of questions today, Rob. I don't think anything too controversial because you are very busy with the book. There's a couple questions that I think are pretty cool, but I say let's get started. What do you think?
Cool. Sounds good.
All right. Number one, we got a question from our friend Squatchy. Says, by the way, do you know anything regarding paleo and or low-carb keto and its effects on OCD? I tried looking some stuff up, but only found one reference to keto and OCD, and it didn't really say much. Also found a forum post with a few people talking about paleo curing OCD. My OCD is definitely better on low carb and seemed to get even better when I went paleo as well. It's mostly a non-issue now. Thanks.
Yeah, we've done a little digging on this in the past. Like the mechanisms with OCD are different from person to person, but we definitely see some gut issue, like grain, legume, dairy you know, intolerances that seem to irritate the gut, leads into some sort of that like psychoneuroimmunology, you know, like the gut influencing neurochemistry. And that's one piece of it. So we've got that classic, you know, just kind of gut-mediated irritation. Then we've got that omega-3, omega-6 imbalance, which we know for a fact the good amounts of EPA, DHA, DHA in particular, are very, very helpful for OCD, ADHD, you know, all these kind of attention deficit type scenarios. That's helpful. And it's also helpful with inflammation. And then we start getting into that kind of ketogenic realm of running on largely ketone bodies instead of glucose. This changes what they call the redox potential in the brain. And when we alter the redox potential, and this gets a little bit geeky, but this is kind of the basic engine of how we generate energy in our body, you know, at the mitochondrial level, and we can generate a little bit of energy via glycolysis, but that's not really a way that we want to fuel our body, and it's certainly not the way that we want to fuel the metabolism of our brain. And when we shift from a glucose-based metabolism to a ketone-based metabolism, or largely ketone-based metabolism, it dramatically changes the redox potential. And this is some of the work of a metabolic control analysis like Seyfried, Veach, and some of the other guys that are real heavy into the cancer and ketosis research. But there's some really similar overlap here. So that, though, you know, from a mechanistic level, we can argue both from the gut health, the omega-3, omega-6 imbalance, insulin issues, but more specific to the insulin issues is actually the shifting of the metabolic machinery towards a more ketogenic-based profile seems to help fix problems like calcium homeostasis in the brain, how certain neurotransmitters are firing. There's not a lot of information out there yet. It's largely theoretical, but it makes sense. And like Swatchy mentioned here, the just the implementation, you know, give it a shot, see how you do with it. It's pretty remarkable, so it's cool stuff. I had really, really horrible kind of ADHD stuff and some OCD type stuff when I was younger, and it's just gone now. And it really would have been interesting to have gone through school and been able to study and actually focus on stuff and not jump up and like run around the house every 5 minutes like I used to do. So it's pretty cool stuff.
Yeah. I miss my Ritalin days, Rob. That's all I can say.
I think the new kids are doing Adderall these days. I think that's the study drug of choice these days, I hear.
I think you are right. Question number two from Joey. Hey, Rob, what's your take on coconut water for post-workout recovery, maybe mixed with whey for a shake? I've been reading how it's good post-workout, but it seems like just a lot of sugar. What's the deal with it?
You have to, I really like coconut water in general for post-workout, but you have to really fish around to find just plain coconut water. Plain coconut water still has sugar in it, but it's primarily glucose, whereas most of the coconut water that you will find will have a ton of added sucrose to it, which it doesn't really seem like a smart option to me. So if you can find some plain coconut water, I would definitely go for that, but it definitely with the knowledge that, you know, again, who are we talking about here? Who's appropriate for this? Probably lean, hard-charging athletes who are trying to take advantage of some post-workout recovery. Is the whey protein appropriate post-workout? Maybe, you know, play around with that, see how you do with it. Since I've been doing jiu-jitsu again, I've been using some coconut water immediately post-workout because I've just been knackered from that. So I'll do some, you know, half a can of the coconut water immediately post-workout, which usually translates into, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 grams of glucose. And then the nice thing is that it's isotonic balanced electrolytes, so it replenishes magnesium and potassium really nicely. If you were doing a really, really long effort, then I would add actually a little bit of sodium to this just to kind of balance it all out, but that's kind of a different deal. But that has helped get me through the first 20, 30 minutes post-workout. I get home, I grab a sweet potato and some grass-fed meat because we had 180 pounds of grass-fed meat arrive on our doorstep a couple of weeks ago, and that's been my post-workout meal, and that's gone pretty well.
I think you can also use coconut water to help with some mixed drinks, Rob.
Yeah, it makes a hell of a mojito. You take the coconut water, mash up some mint, throw it in there, throw in some lime juice, and then top it off with some ideally dark rum, and it is really good.
Okay.
And booze.
Those are the most popular recipes, Rob, as you've mentioned several times.
Yeah, maybe that's why it took me a year to write this book.
You could have just had like a paleo drinks book, and that just might have been enough, really.
That'll be after we do the recipe book, then it's just paleo mixed drinks for the paleo Playboy or something like that.
There you go. And in a similar vein, we got a comment from Kevin that I just wanted to share. So he says, Rob and Andy made the apple cinnamon and coconut custard last night with a slight modification to make it set up better. So I'm not going to read it. Basically, what he did is rather than using the two cans of coconut, he used one can of coconut and swapped the other can and replaced it with coconut oil, and mm-hmm. then used the large apples and cinnamons and cooked it and then pureed it and stored it in the fridge overnight. So I played with this as well, and obviously it does help kind of thicken it and get a better consistency. I know, Rob, you commented you could also probably use some xanthan gum to kind of help make it a little bit more custard-like.
Yeah. And the switch out there is smart with what Kevin did. The coconut oil is just more dense in the fat content. And being a saturated fat, it has, it's solid at room temperature. So when you throw the whole thing together, you're going to have some sort of a meeting point between room temperature and your refrigerator in which solidification of this thing, the melting point is going to be met, and it's going to set up better. So that's a smart move. Good kitchen chemistry there.
So Rob, I'm going to throw this out at you for the next evolution. I'm going to take this and put it in the ice cream maker. What do you think about that?
Oh, I think that's nifty. You know, especially if you had one that you could whip just a little bit of air into it, which mm-hmm. is a lot of the mouthfeel of conventional ice cream, American style ice cream versus like gelato, yep. is actually a little bit of air bubbles. You get some of that mouthfeel is just simply the air bubbles in it. So yeah, I like it.
It's the next evolution. We'll see. Always trying to eat more coconut. That's my rules.
More coconut and better living through chemistry. So.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. Cool. All right. Next, we got a kind of lengthy question from SB, so I'll kind of weave my way through this. It says, hi, Rob. Again, great podcast. Currently working as a wellness facilitator at a corporation in Toronto. I conduct wellness appraisals and fitness testing for the employees and help each person make adjustments in their lifestyle. Currently working with an employee who in the past had a regular physical activity schedule, but unfortunately became very lightheaded and tired. She'd be feeling fine, then all of a sudden she says she would become so fatigued she was unable to drive herself home. Had numerous tests on the doctor, but nothing was found. I asked about iron levels, but she told me she's been taking iron supplements regularly for the last 20 years. Also asked if she was eating regularly, and she says she was. As always, the question is, how often really are you eating? She's been feeling better for about a year and is now trying to lose a little bit of weight. She says that since I have been at the company encouraging physical activity, she has lost 9 pounds. However, today she informed me that for the last 2 days, within an hour of eating, she begins to feel lightheaded. Says this feeling lasts about 15 minutes and then goes away. I'm not sure what this could be about. She has told me that the only change in her diet is she's been avoiding or eliminating sugars. Since this feeling only occurs after she has finished eating, I do not think that it's related to blood sugar. As for what she is eating, she told me that today she had a homemade beef burger and a large green salad. I do not see a problem with this either. Is there anything else that I could suggest, or what do you think this is from? Sorry for the super long post, but it would be great if you could direct me to some articles that I could read to find out more. Many thanks.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many moving parts to this. Like when I was first reading this, I was just in the back of my head kind of thinking maybe like adrenal fatigue. The lightheaded deal can mean a bunch of different things to different people. Like some people will go from a seated position to standing and get lightheadedness that is kind of indicative of hypovolemic kind of blood response. And so they're not getting enough blood and oxygen to the brain. So they'll call that lightheaded. Other people, and that can actually be a little bit indicative of, say, like sleep loss or adrenal insufficiency, kind of elevated cortisol levels. People will give the same terminology for just what we would ascribe to a blood sugar crash. So it's a little hard to kind of ferret out what the heck is going on there. And then also you just don't really know when people say, I've been trying to cut back on sugar. Usually that's like a huge kind of thing. It's kind of like, okay, so if you're cutting back on sugar, then you were probably eating a lot. And if that's the case, we could have both an adrenal problem because of the hyperinsulinism causing some adrenocortical activity, which can lead into some kind of hypovolemic type things, which would fit with some of the symptoms. But then also you've got just the simple problem of, you know, she's shifting from a carbohydrate kind of based fueling to more of a protein and fat based fueling, which is going to leave some lag time there. So, I mean, there needs to be a little bit more tinkering, or I would need a little more information. Even if I was working with this person, probably what I would recommend is that she just kind of stay the course on this. I would want to know how much she's sleeping, that sort of stuff, and maybe a specific food log to see, you know, is she really getting pretty good compliance? Does she need to add a little more fat? If this is a dramatic shift or departure away from the way that she was eating, then maybe this is just some adaptation that's going on, and she'll normalize with a little bit of change. But it sounds like she's had some stuff going on for a while, so that, you know, it's not surprising that this is a little bit of a complex scenario. But I would just try to figure out first, what was she eating before, exactly how is she eating now, and if there's a pretty big difference with that may be the biggest part. And there could be some adrenal and insulin, you know, kind of blood sugar related things, both working in synchrony there.
Yep. Cool. Good question. And if give us a follow up if you tinker with this and like to kind of see what goes on.
Yeah, and SB asked for articles, and I can't. It'd be hard to pick out some specific articles for just this. Like, I'll try to remember. There's a doc that talks about the effects of hyperinsulinism on cortisol. And I'll try to get that in the show notes, but I'm not even sure where I remember reading that. So, yeah.
Yep. Cool. All right. Now we got a question from T. It says, great podcast. I'm a faithful Tuesday night listener over dinner. I mean.
Seems like it'd be horrible for your digestion. But
there's so many things wrong with that statement. But, you know, if it works for this person, more power.
Absolutely. We're faithful. Yeah.
As a reformed vegetarian, I enjoy the carnivore tips. On my last local grass-fed beef order, I felt cool asking for all the fat to be rendered into tallow and to make sure to include all the marrow bones. The butcher guy said, no problem. Nobody usually wants that stuff, even though it's part of the hanging weight price calculation. Well done. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Quick question. I recently read Natural Hormone and Hormonal Enhancement, NHE, and I'm trying to reconcile his recommendations for carb loads only every 4 days with your suggestion to sometimes include carbs post-workout. I try to always schedule big low-fat, moderate protein carb load dinners 1 to 2 times a week on a workout day with lots of yams, squash, tomato sauce, fruit, etc. So he kind of breaks this into 3 questions for us. So question 1. When is it appropriate to ditch the 3 or 4 day rule and throw in mega carbs after every workout? Long Metcon to prevent cortisol only when short-term recovery performance is the objective over long-term hormonal balance? Thoughts, Robs?
Yeah. For that first question, it's when you have a performance bias versus more of a health and longevity bias. And Rob Fagan did a pretty darn good job on that book, and he does a pretty good job of explaining that, you know, if you wanted to, that you could develop pretty good performance, pretty good capacity following his exercise recommendations and the fueling that would come out of that once every 3 to 4 day carb refeed. But he acknowledges that for elite athletics, you're going to need to train and eat in a way that may be contrary to health and longevity bias. And, you know, and then, you know, make your decisions based on that. And this is where for a long time when I would look at the CrossFit type templates, I would kind of assess the volume of the CrossFit template based on could I fuel it and could I do it with kind of a cyclic low carb approach. And if so, then there was probably a good balance of volume and intensity there. Like if I could pull that off and structured around that, it was pretty good. Now, was that going to produce CrossFit Games level performance? Probably not, but it was kind of a sustainable kind of strength bias kind of scenario.
Good. Question 2. My understanding of the book is that by eating extremely low carb, less than 30 grams daily net, for all meals except carb loads, I would be optimizing my long-term hormonal balance towards burning fat for energy. Would this include optimizing growth hormone, testosterone, leptin, etc.?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I don't think there's any doubt with that, that kind of that punctuated ketogenic kind of diet, Martin Burkham with lean gains, like this is largely what he ends up doing. There's some really good cachet to this. We see it with everybody from Mauro Di Pasquale. I've played with this a ton. It for certain situations, it's hard to find the sweet spot, and so it may just boil down to something like what John Berardi did, which is kind of the massive eating scenario that you could apply to just an athletic scene, which is just post-workout protein carb, and then the rest of the meals protein fat. And so there's a very large sliding scale with this as to what the frequency needs to be to meet your needs, what the frequency of carbohydrate intake needs to be.
Yep. Question three. NHE also recommends 5 meals a day for optimal hormonal balance. I noticed the book was published in 2000. Have recent studies refuted this concept?
Yeah, definitely. I don't know that that's really necessary at all or even advantageous in the least. And this is kind of the funny thing of the internet, like anything that you write, it's kind of like peeing in a pool. You never get it back out. And I think it wasn't Neil Occhio Grosso. I forget who it was. Somebody was fishing around on old CrossFit message board and found a post of mine where I was recommending 6 meals a day, and that somehow emulated like ancestral eating patterns or something. And then obviously I was pretty wrong about that. So yeah, the 3 meals a day seems to be fine, you know, anywhere from like 1 to 3, 1 to 4. I think a little variation within that is fine.
Yep. And history on T, 36-year-old male, 10% body fat, Wendler 531, prioritize outdoor sports. Paleo, usually it's 2 meals a day. Objectives are strength while maintaining a reasonable strength to weight ratio, unwilling to go mad for outdoor sport performance.
Cool. Very cool. Yeah, good questions, and a good book. It's kind of funny. I offered some suggestions to Rob Fagan, you know, mentioning grass-fed versus grain-fed and some sourcing, and just said, hey, if you ever do a follow-up edition to the book, I would recommend these editions. And I don't know if he still has it, but he used to have this Ask Rob forum where he would joust and contest. The dude's a lawyer, and I guess he just absolutely gets off arguing with people. Like he had a big argument with Clarence Bass and big argument with Pavel Satsulini, and then in there there's this thing, feisty biochemistry student takes Rob to task or something like that, which was me taking him to task. And all I was saying was, if you put a, you know, the book is fantastic, I would just recommend adding in the additional, like if you would like to bring this even further, make it grass-fed, make it free-range, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, that's just preposterous. Nobody's going to do that. That's the realm of hippies and pie-in-the-sky dreamers and all this stuff. And it turned into this huge pissing match. Instead of the dude just either one, it's just kind of funny to me, either he says, hey, man, thanks a lot, cool, and then he blows me off, or he's actually like, oh, that's cool. When I'm out of this next round of books, I'll update it and I'll stick some legit information in there. And it's just kind of funny considering this was a really good book, given that it was released in 2000. Had he done a little bit of tweaking and fiddling with that, he would have been in a really nice position to kind of like own that market. But he just pretty much took a pee down my back on the whole thing. So.
I'm just laughing, Rob. This is much like every conversation you and I have about anything. So, anyway, moving on.
I didn't invite him to move to Chico, though, and I did you. So I don't know what that says about anything. So,
well, that's right. He may have less regrets.
Seriously.
Good question, though. And I think, once again, can't say enough about Wendler 531 as well. I think we're both big fans of the book, and at least the idea of having a plan and being able to make some objective decisions about how you're progressing towards that plan, which obviously Wendler is a big fan of.
Very slick, very, very easy to use, very easy to modify. I've tweaked it significantly now that I'm doing jiu-jitsu, and it's still, you know, it's the backbone of what my SNC is. It's pretty cool.
Cool. All right, Rob, question 6 is my question/comment of the week. Yay. Question from Mark R. It says, hey, Rob, haven't listened to this podcast yet, so this was from a couple weeks ago, but seeing as a CrossFit Games athlete is one of the topics, I thought that this comment on a post at the Lean Saloon was appropriate to bring up. Like you say, define your goals and know what trade-offs are being taken. My favorite part of the comment, the irony is I feel way healthier, much better, and I look way better. Made me think about the recent podcast where someone referred to Tommy Hackenbruck or Miko Salo looking glassy-eyed. So basically Mark says, my computer is went crazy. Says, I've done CrossFit for 4 years. I have scored close to 400 on Fight Gone Bad for the past 3 years with standardized technique. During the same amount of time, I also ate the Zone Paleo diet. Felt great, but I never had anything more than a 4-pack. I was consistently above 12% body fat, just never managed the physique I always wished for. Meanwhile, I became dreaded with always having to push myself to the limits with exercise. Even with excellent technique in most exercises, I had elbow tendonitis, shoulder pain, and hip pain. 5 months ago, I stopped CrossFitting and just started doing a much more laid-back workout routine with less frequency and intensity, and decided to add intermittent fasting to actually create a true calorie deficit instead of relying on exercise. Since I started IFing, I am actually way leaner. For the first time, I'm seeing a 6-pack. But if you asked me to do Fight Gone Bad today, I don't think I could even get past 300. The irony is I feel way healthier, much better, and look way better. I wish I knew this 4 years ago rather than beating myself up senselessly and believing this is what it took to get lean. I wish I knew it was as easy as taking a break from eating here and there, like you say, turn off the valve. And on this comment, he says, and like you, Johnny, I'd much rather have a 6-pack and feel great. By the way, 50 burpees took me 5:54, and I don't feel bad about it either. I'll get better at burpees for sure, but now I know they don't determine my 6-pack abs.
Yeah, it's an interesting, question/commentary here, just that trade-off of elite performance versus kind of a body composition. And I would probably argue kind of a health and longevity bias, and this is that thing that I wrote for the performance menu years ago, where instead of just simply a mapping of, work capacity being multiple mixed modal work capacity kind of thing, and then if you extrapolate that over time, this theoretical three-dimensional fitness, it's kind of interesting, but when we really get down and look at it, it's not predictive at all of what we see. When folks start getting in and they start really pushing the performance side of things, we see biomarkers of longevity and health go south. That's just a fact. And it's not putting a value judgment on that, but I think a lot of people go into a lot of different stuff, whether it was marathoning and then triathlon, and now I think kind of the sport of fitness, CrossFit kind of gig, they go into it oftentimes with a large desire for health and wellness. Now, obviously, the fun factor is kind of the main deal. Like, it's rare that you have somebody who just works out just because, like, I want to live to be 90, and they do drudgerous type stuff. So usually they're doing something fun. And a lot of this mixed modal competitive type stuff can be quite fun for folks, but it can also, lead to burnout if there's not periodization, all that other sort of stuff. But there is no doubt that an inflection point exists in which if you simply want to be lean, look jacked, look good naked, have good blood lipids, have pretty damn good capacity for like anything short of like elite athletic type of performance, then you can do that, and it's comparatively easy, God forbid you almost go back to almost like a bodybuilding-esque sort of deal. Let's say we tackle a bodybuilding approach from a largely functional fitness perspective. So squats, deadlifts, weighted pull-ups, rope climbs, handstand push-ups, being 85-90% of your makeup, do 10% of some isolation work, curls, tricep extension, shoulder work for some balance, and then do a little bit of anaerobic, graded anaerobic work, which Clarence Bass has done some great writing on this. Instead of just beating yourself into the ground, say let's take a 500 meter rower approach for one example. Let's say you're going to do that for your anaerobic efforts 2 or 3 days a week. Maybe the first time I sit down and do it, I pull a 2-minute 500 meter split, and then I rest 2 minutes, and I do that that week, and then the next week I shoot for like a 155 or 150, and then the next week like a 145. So I actually do a graded increase on that instead of simply trying to figure out how much I can destroy myself on that that activity. And by these graded progressive overload techniques and a little bit of undulating periodization, we can be lean, we can be strong, we can be damn healthy, and there's really not that much suffering involved. Now, if you want to have a world-class Fran time, or you want to compete at the CrossFit Games, or if you want to be a great jiu-jitsu player or something like that, that's probably not the way that you're going to tackle this. But you could look great, be strong, generally pretty fit, definitely quite healthy, and it doesn't have to be a complete beatdown. And that's a reality. That's a fact. And so it's very interesting. Pat Sherwood had a CrossFit Journal post where, or a video piece where he talked about his idiot suit, where his desired level of leanness was lower than what was supported by his desire for performance. So like if he wanted to perform well, he had to carry a little more body fat than what he would otherwise like to carry. And that's just a wise understanding of the trade-offs and inherent with those things.
And who wouldn't want to look like Clarence Bass? That's what I say, Rob.
You know, dude is pretty jacked, man. He's done a damn good job navigating all this stuff. I'm not 100% behind his food, but sure. You know, he's always been whole foods. He's been for me a little bit on the higher carb side, but it's always been whole foods. And the dude's always been very, very smart in his training. And near 70 years old now, right?
Yeah,
and he's right at 70.
Yeah, and I think his latest pictures that I saw maybe 6 months ago were from when he was 70. Although, you know, I'm not supporting a 70-year-old man taking pictures in Speedos, but
under any circumstances. But yeah, but
yeah, I guess if you got it, flaunt it. You know,
props to him nonetheless. You know, and he still digs what he's doing. He's done it his whole life. He's educated literally, I would say, millions of people on a healthier way of living and being and all that. And that's pretty impressive.
Yep. Really cool. All right. Good question.
Totally.
All right, Rob. Next, I got a question from Travis, and I'm going to have you help me with one of the words.
Ankylosing spondylitis.
Ankylosing spondylitis. Nice. Rob and Andy, thank you so much for this podcast. I've been interested in the paleo diet for years now. Listening to your podcast helped me finally take the plunge and change my diet. I'm feeling better all around. I have a good friend who has recently been diagnosed with ankylosing spondylitis. He's 29 now, and I know he's suffered with intense back pain and hip stiffness and pain since he was 20, maybe longer. For a while in college, he was basically living off painkillers like a leaf. It's a relief that he finally knows what's causing his pain, but the diagnosis doesn't sound too good to me. I think he's just been given some medications to manage his symptoms, but it sounds like there's a good chance that the disease might still worsen with age. My friend has always been prone to pretty extreme diets of all sorts, followed by huge junk food binges, which can last for weeks or months. He has also always been somewhat active in various types of exercise routines, usually tending towards powerlifting, which he used to think causes back pain. I was wondering if you could explain what ankylosing spondylitis is and whether or not the paleo diet might help. If so, could you also lay out how strict he should be with his diet? I'm wondering about some gray area items. For instance, should someone in his condition limit eggs and nuts in addition to grains, legumes, and dairy? He's pretty good at sticking to regimens as long as they are strict with no wriggle room. Also, what exercise routine would you recommend with someone with his condition? His goals would be, first and foremost, to help manage the ankylosing spondylitis, and probably second, to get 70s big.
Who doesn't want to be 70s big?
Exactly. Are there any sort of exercise he should avoid, e.g. heavy squatting, etc.? Thanks again for all the good work.
The ankylosing spondylitis is a pretty invasive and aggressive form of autoimmune disease, and it's bad news. And like, if you want to both live a long time and live pretty well, you have to take it really seriously. And our default place to go with that is that grain, legume, dairy free. I would definitely, because of the obvious autoimmune element of this, I would also omit, you know, nightshades, tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants. I would omit eggs, nuts, and seeds. And I would get that to a spot where, like, let's ideally put this thing into remission, which I think you could do. We've had commentary on my blog from people who appear to have put ankylosing spondylitis into remission. I know Professor Cordain has some examples of this, but you need to tackle the whole thing aggressively. And then you have to kind of decide, okay, how much latitude do I want to give myself from there? And how worth it is it to play around with things like eggs, nuts, seeds, et cetera? And that's kind of a subjective deal. I don't have an answer for that. One, we don't know what specifically of those items is a problem. Sometimes it's only a problem when we have certain life stressors. You know, sometimes putting the whole condition into remission will buy you more wiggle room with regards to those types of foods. Like, there's just a ton of unknown on this. It's a little bit cryptic in that it sounds like the guy has a tendency of seriously going off rails and just going bananas for a period of time, which is really hard on the system. And like, if he does that with the ankylosing spondylitis, he's going to be right back where he was originally. And frankly, the goal of getting 70s big with this condition seems nuts to me. Like, I don't know specifically what moves he can or can't do. I would need to do an assessment and work with this person directly. Maybe squats are okay, maybe they're not. I don't know. There's no way that I can really make a solid recommendation on that. I think being lean, being highly mobile, and then working within the confines of the movements that don't cause him significant problem. And if he gets a handle on this, he should be able to do more work, but he needs to really focus on getting healthy and being lean and keeping his inflammation down if he wants to live a pain-free long life. And this is like a serious, no-joke scenario. Like, it needs to be taken deadly seriously, in my opinion.
Good question. So there, Rob?
I'm there. I'm here.
Okay. All right, man. I thought I died.
Nope.
Good question. Cool. All right. And next, we got a question from Sarah. She says, I'm a 36-year-old female looking for vitality, longevity, strength, and leanness, mostly in that order. I was wondering if there are any programming, nutrition, or supplement differences you've identified and might recommend between men and women, or is everything I've learned from Rob applied equally to men and women? Thanks so much.
I thought about this one a lot. And, you know, I've seen a few women benefit from a little increased iodine intake, and maybe some men would too, but it seems to pop up more with women in that we see some overt problems with menstrual cycle problems. And who knows, maybe some men would benefit from a little more iodine. Maybe it would help prop up like a testosterone function and stuff like that. Like, that's something I had not really considered. But, you know, by and large, I don't see that much of a sexual dimorphism here. You know, like, it ends up the size, the needs of the men and women seem to be pretty similar. You know, with the caveat, though, I will say this, this really heavy mixed modal activity seems to do some really magical stuff for females and sometimes some horrific stuff to males. And I guess if I were to put one caveat in that, I would put in the caveat that I think in general most men would look better, feel better with a little bit more of a strength and kind of hypertrophy biased kind of training program with enough metabolic conditioning to be lean and do whatever it is you want to do. But if there was some sort of a difference there, then I would say it's probably right along that level. The growth hormone release from mixed modal training, OPT wrote an article about this in the Performance Menu a couple of years back. And it seems to really set stuff right for females. A similar mechanism occurs for males, but because of the volume and the intensity, I think we start seeing kind of a muscle wasting effect over the long haul. So if there was any demarcation there, I would just generally kind of say men would probably benefit from a little more hypertrophy, you know, strength bias type training.
Don't say it, Rob.
I know. I know.
Good. All right. I'm glad you were.
It's out there. It's out there now.
I'm glad you were able to say that publicly. Good question, though. That was good.
Yeah.
Next, we got a comment or a question from Jessica. Hey, Rob. Thanks for all the help on the podcast. Listening to them was one of the biggest ways my husband got me to buy into this whole paleo thing. Two questions are completely unrelated. Thanks for your help on either or both of them. So one question I already took care of. Question two, she says, people seem to show little interest when I suggest paleo as a solution to infertility. I've done some research on the internet, but can't seem to find a nice, clean answer to what effects paleo food changes have on infertility problems. I know you have touched on this topic in at least two other podcasts, but it'd be awesome to have the definitive Here's Why Paleo Gets You Knocked Up podcast. Thanks for everything. Can't wait for the book.
Well, I'm really reticent, especially with there's a whole background story that I can't tell people about. But whenever anybody starts talking about a definitive anything, then there's danger. There's like, danger, Will Robinson, danger. So I've just got to throw that out there. Someday we may be able to crack this open, but I can't now. So that's the only teaser I can dangle with regards to that. But, you know, this again, it goes back to the same stuff. We within infertility, whether we're talking male or female infertility, we have hyperinsulinism issues. We have quasi-autoimmune type issues that lead into inflammation, both in like the ovaries and in the Leydig cells and the testicles. Then we have like omega-3, omega-6 imbalances. We have lifestyle issues that are influential in cortisol production. It is not, in my opinion, a singular solution. It's a multi-pronged approach. In our gym, you know, we tackle nutrition and lifestyle and try our best to instill smart training practices and all that sort of stuff. And I think recently we had 12 women, Andy, that were pregnant at the gym. Is that right? 10, 12?
I want to say maybe 10, but I don't. This is something that I don't track.
Yeah. But a bunch, you know.
A lot,
and
yes.
It's just and it has been like somewhere between like an 8 and a 12 person, you know, count of women being pregnant for like 2 years. And the folks roll into the gym, they start working out, they tweak their nutrition, they work out better, we're all over them about their sleep, and they get pregnant. And so it's not that there's a singular element here. I am looking down the road, like I would like to do a follow-up book and actually tackle this and get in and really get the mechanisms really well described. But the big things are that we normalize estrogen progesterone profile. So like just on a basic level, there's an opportunity for a fertilized egg to find a favorable uterine environment in which to implant. If estrogen levels are too high, if we don't get a normal progesterone swing during that whole course with a fertilized egg, then it's damn near impossible for the egg to implant. If there are autoimmune problems causing irritation on the ovaries, then the likelihood of discharging an egg are very, very low. And that can also lead into some estrogen progesterone problems. So it gets very, very layered. And then whenever we have a cortisol issue, it, you know, if you're under a lot of stress, that's a great signal to send to your biological systems that you should not be pregnant right now. So it there's a lot of stuff. And the way that we try to tackle it is synergistic and kind of like that shotgun art approach. It's like, let's cover all bases. All of them are synergistic. All of them feed in together. Gluten is just a standalone item, is understood to be antagonistic to fertility in a couple of different ways. So let's just tackle all that stuff. Throw it all in a bag. Do it all at once. And then with hopefully, you know, the result being folks getting pregnant, feeling, performing better. And then if they want to get knocked up, that's kind of the end result. So I can't say that there's a definitive one-word answer to this. It's a multi-pronged issue. Different people have different elements of this. And even with some pretty extensive testing, you wouldn't necessarily uncover what specifically they have going on. Because like maybe their cortisol levels are a little high, but within normal bounds, but do you really enact a cortisol program? It's like, yeah, you do all of that stuff. That's where the integrated approach works so well.
Yep. There's no definitive answer to anything, Rob.
I don't know. Bad time. Total domains.
Well, except for that obvious answer, and the magical zone ratio obviously is definitive.
That's true. There are two anchors in our otherwise chaotic universe. So.
Good question. Thank you, Jessica. Totally. Next, we got a question from Chris. Says, excellent podcast as usual. I've got my mom eating healthier and healthier over the past while. She's eating mostly paleo the majority of the time and has been losing weight, feeling great, and looking better. She told me this morning that she's noticed the past couple of times she's eaten bread, she's had hot flashes. She's postmenopausal and in her 50s. I thought that was pretty interesting and told her I'd ask you about it. From what I've read, it sounds like gluten can mess with your adrenals from the inflammation stress it causes, which can throw your hormones out of whack, to put it simply. I'm curious how much of the symptoms women experience during menopause are natural and how much of them may be attributed to diet. What's your take on this stuff? Maybe a good podcast topic.
Yeah, just to back up, like, the gluten is absolutely a problem in that. Other foods can be a problem in that whole scenario, like the food intolerance story is you know, very, very important in all those regards, with releasing cortisol, kind of stirring the whole system up. And then there was a book, I forget the title of it. They were tackling this more from a vegetarian approach though, but it was looking at there are certain cultures that just don't really have a word for menopause, or they don't really notice that as distinct a transition from childbearing years to menopausal years, and not the type of like hot flashes and bone demineralization and all that sort of stuff that's pretty typical with our westernized culture. Gosh, I just can't remember the name of the book. It was like a early 90s book. It largely vegetarian, but they were recommending like tofu and like high phytoestrogen intake and all this sort of stuff to try to mask the problems associated with menopause. But the folks that we've talked to, good anecdotal kind of place to start from this. If we normalize the insulin levels, decrease inflammation, have omega-3, omega-6 fats in good ratios, we see people do really well in this scenario. They tend not to have the horrible hot flashes, bone demineralization, and all that sort of stuff. Obviously, there's a pretty dramatic change that occurs here, but it's quite different than people who are eating kind of a standard American diet. And this gets a little controversial. We don't really have time to get real deep into it here, but there's a reality also that from kind of an ancestral perspective, women who make it to, say, like age 40, age 50, age 60, historically they would have had far fewer menstrual cycles than what modern women are experiencing. You hit age 13, 14, you go through puberty, the likelihood of getting pregnant was pretty high not too long after that. This is just what we see from kind of hunter-gatherer agriculturalist societies. And in a situation in which the woman is not overwhelmed with dietary carbohydrate and other things that are raising estrogen levels such that they suppress progesterone while breastfeeding, women would normally see a birth spacing of about 2.5 to 3 years between children. And so they wouldn't see that many total menstrual cycles. And so when you extrapolate this out, there's the potential that in the past, and I'm going a little bit theoretical here, this is some stuff that I need to do more research on, but the numbers work out. Theoretically, in the past, a woman could have lived a lot longer but still maintained kind of a normal, still had eggs, still had normal cycle even into advanced age, just because they weren't burning through all of the eggs as frequently. And I've got to give a huge caveat. This is just a theory of mine. I haven't done nearly enough background research to be able to give this any legs at all. I could be 100% wrong. But there is a reality that women's menstrual cycle frequency was definitely less in the past, and we can make the assumption that that is the normal kind of default mode. And so I think that is definitely an interesting area of investigation that we could look at sometime, next couple of months.
Yep. Cool. Thank you for the question.
Yeah, good question.
Next, got a question from Thalen. Hey, Rob, thanks for another great podcast. Just a quick question. Your comment on gluten avoidance at restaurants put me off balance. I'm doing my best to avoid gluten, and I thought that for people who are not clinically celiac, it is enough to pay attention to what you order. You seem to suggest that we also should be requesting restaurants to take some additional precautions. Could you elaborate that on that in a future podcast? What are the non-obvious measures we should request? And then how much gluten traces actually count as contamination? Should we worry about this in order to avoid autoimmune diseases? Thanks.
You know, the total amount that you need to avoid, I don't really know on that. Like one molecule of gluten theoretically could be enough to be a problem. The Primal Body, Primal Mind, which I have not read yet because I haven't been allowed to read any other books until my book is done, but I know she mentions in there, and Andy, maybe you could fill this in a little bit, that you know, one gluten exposure could last as long as like 6 months with regards to collateral inflammation is that's correct, right?
Yeah, that's basically what, yes.
Did she give any type of an indicator in that what the dosage was? Like how much gluten did you need to be exposed to for that to be a problem? Or?
You know, not that I recall. I would suspect, based on my impression of everything I read and hear from her, she is on the more Matt LaLonde militant side of the house,
right.
A la, you know, no fruit is the right amount of fruit and things like that. So, you know, my suspicion is that it's a pretty small amount, but I don't think – I can't recall her specifically commenting on that.
Right. I know for myself it a minute, like a ridiculously small amount will get me sick. And so I have problems all the time while I'm traveling. The places that are sneaky that it can pop up, say, you know, you order a salad and normally the salad comes with croutons and you say, hey, can you leave the croutons off that? And the waiter dutifully writes down no croutons. Then when the chef prepares the salad, they throw it in the same bowl that they just mixed a salad that had croutons. And so you need to say, hey, no croutons, and can that salad be mixed in a fresh bowl? And then you're just kind of hoping that the chef or cook or whoever's doing this stuff is either both conscientious enough and not so busy that they actually follow through and do it. Contamination on a grill. I was having problems at one of our local restaurants that we went to. I would eat a little bit of fruit, and I would have eggs over medium, some bacon, and some fruit. And I kept asking them, you know, where are you cooking the eggs? What about the bacon? Those things were prepared on their own grill. They never saw pancakes, and I couldn't figure it out. And then I said, well, how do you cut your fruit? What do you do with the fruit? And she said, well, we cut the bread in the morning, and then we cut the fruit up later, and they used the same knives and the same cutting boards. And from a hygiene perspective, there's no problem with that. It's not like they're cutting up meat, so there's not going to be some sort of a bacterial contamination with that. But from a gluten standpoint, it was horrible. You know, it was like I was getting a massive dose out of that, and it became really, really frustrating. So there are so many places and so many ways that you can get contamination. It kind of makes your head spin. What I've been telling folks more recently when I eat at the restaurant is that I have a almost life-threatening, you know, allergy to gluten, and that I need my stuff completely clean. And also, I ask about like grilled meats, fish. Sometimes is a little bit easier because it doesn't have any type of sauces or anything. I'll just ask for like a grilled fish or a shrimp cocktail or something like that when I'm on the road. So I find foods that I tend to have some success with, and I just stick with that.
Yes, yeah, and there's definitely restaurants that I notice where it's like, oh, I just don't go there anymore, because you'll run into this little problem where I'm like, why am I sick? I didn't eat anything that I know contained things that bother me.
Mm-hmm.
But still, there was some contamination. So no magic solution, Rob. No definitive answer.
No, you just have to be fastidious and ask questions and keep your eyes open. And if you get sick there, maybe talk to the owner, talk to the manager. And if they're not willing or able to modify, then go someplace else. Yeah. Ironically, and this doesn't help very many people, definitely doesn't help Thalen, who's in Italy, but In-N-Out Burger, like, I never get sick there. Never, yeah. never get sick. They purposefully separate their food preparation scene so that the gluten-containing items never come near the other foods. So yep. It's pretty legit.
In-N-Out Burger is a win for sure.
Yes.
And finally, a question from Johnny. I'm not sure a blog comment is the best place to do this, but can you expound a little more on building volume and layers, pinking phases, and periodization, especially periodization of mixed modal activities? Could this be as simple as hit it hard for X weeks, dial back volume, intensity, and loading for X weeks, and then hit it hard again? How does peaking and periodization work if you don't have a specific event you are training for?
That's a great question. It's kind of hard as hell. Like, you need to pick some benchmarks at the very least, you know, a back squat, a deadlift, a Diane, a Fran. You need something to shoot for. The periodization is periodized around kind of a specific endpoint or a specific goal. Otherwise, here's the deal. If you don't really have some sort of goals to base this stuff on, then you might as well just completely randomize it, because it really doesn't matter. If you don't have a goal in mind, then it really doesn't matter. And going through the extra process of the periodization is a little bit silly. Then you could just simply say hard, medium, easy, and call it good. One week real hard, 1 week medium, 1 week easy, maybe a week off, rotate, you know, would be is the level of complexity you need. So you really do need to delineate some goals on this stuff, and then you can start layering in volume and intensity. But again, like, the goals will dictate this. So it's really hard to just construct this out of the ether. If I'm currently at a 1.5 times body weight back squat and I want to get to like a 2 times body weight back squat, then we can start thinking about like, okay, maybe, you know, I'm still very much in that beginner phase of strength development. So I could think about like a 2 or maybe even a 3 times a week back squat protocol, kind of like a starting strength or something like that, that would get me some really, really good results. And then if I'm talking about, okay, I'm at a 2 times body weight back squat, I want to get to like a 2.5 times body weight back squat, then Wendler might, we're definitely done with a starting strength linear progression. Something like a Wendler scenario might be appropriate, but we might need something similar to like a sets across pre-Leppin chart, like a 8x3, 8x2, 5x1 kind of peaking cycle to get there, and then start to look at accessory movements that we're doing to get that going on. If we're talking about metabolic conditioning, it can be as simple as let's take like I always like Kellen, be it, you know, a run, swing, pull up. The first time you do it, you jog through it. The next time you do it, you jog a little faster. You know, I mean, it's maybe every fifth or sixth time you do it, you go for a benchmark kind of effort. And then off of that benchmark, we could then periodize intensities, which are basically time indexes. Say like if you could do Helen, this is just to make the numbers easy, but your best effort was 10 minutes on it, then when we started working, if we were doing 70% effort, then we would add, say, like 3 minutes to that whole thing, and we would expect to finish Helen in 13 minutes. Would be kind of an additional or 70%, you know, less intense, or 30% less intense. You'd be at 70% intensity on that. So there's a lot of different ways of tackling that, but it's very task specific and very specific to where you are. You know, there's a lot of moving parts on that, and having some goals really helps delineate where to go.
Yes. Why do goals matter, Rob? Silly.
Gives your life meaning, Andy.
It's the unknown and the unknowable, Rob.
Indeed.
You can never prepare. Well, that's it, man. Episode 37. I think that went pretty well.
Cool. Nobody died. You didn't die. I didn't die. So that was good.
I'm going to go eat a lot of meat, though, before I go back to work.
Cool. I like it.
All right, man. Well, thank you very much for your time. Good luck editing the book this weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.
Right on, Andy. Thanks.
All right. See you, Rob.
Bye-bye.